Okay, well, we got the word on the convention, and now your next little bullet point would be what?
Well, I would like to talk a little bit about work and tasks. So according to the ADA, a service dog can provide many different behaviors to help a person with a disability. And these behaviors are work and tasks, and the way that we differentiate them is that tasks are actively requested. There are things like, you know, get me a bottle of water from the fridge, bring me my medications when the alarm goes off, or, you know, things like that. Then there's also passively available work, and the passively available work is things that the dog does depending on, it does it on its own by sensing changes in the environment or changes in the handler. And so it's a command, the task is a command-based system, and work is more of a change in the handler or the environment type of situation. All of them are trained for recognition of the disability symptom and then to respond to that disability symptom. Let's see what else about them. We have a work and task list on our website. It's under the resources section. I'm going to go there right now and tell you what the address is. I should have had that available. So the address is psychdogpartners.org/resources/work-tasks. And this webpage has several things on it. It's my husband is the co-treasurer and the secretary for Psychiatric Service Dog Partners. He has a physical disability, not a mental one. And he used to be into philosophy and went to graduate school for philosophy. And work and tasks are kind of his baby. He's written several articles about work and task theory, and some of them are a little bit dense to get through, but they're really, really worth it once you understand what he's saying. But it's not something that, you know, you really need to understand for your daily service dog life. It's something that you might want to look into and learn about. The more helpful part of the work and task page is our work and task list, which is a listing of a bunch of symptoms on the left-hand side of the page, like symptoms like, for example, anxiety or mood swing or flashback, things like that. And then on the right-hand side of the page, there are listing of what type of work or tasks a dog can be trained to do to help with the disability. And then on the far right side is a description of whether the behavior is work or task.
That's cool.
There is some controversy is about work and tasks. There are some organizations that are trying to get work removed from the ADA or the Department of Justice's interpretation of the ADA. Luckily, the Department of Justice, when they redid the ADA laws recently, they came out very strongly siding with the people who said keep the work and task or work or task language so that dogs that do all different types of things, are covered. Again, what we think is that it's important that the dog is helping someone with a disability, not whether it's a work or task item. But work or task, it's helpful for knowing if it qualifies as some type of behavior that the dog is recognizing and responding to stuff. We really think that it's important that the dog is responding to the disability, not if it's a work or task. Looking at this might help you, looking at the work and task list might help you learn what you need to train your dog to do to help you out.
Yes, I think, and I can only think because I'm not on the board up there at the Department of Justice or the ADA, but I think what they're trying to do is make a clear line of differentiation between the emotional support dog and the service dog, psychological service dog, because of the perceived abuses on either side of that line. I think that's what they're really trying to do with the language. And,
exactly.
You know, it takes education and knowledge, and for intelligent conversations to go on. And again, part of the problem with people who need psychiatric service dogs is a lot of the manifestation of their disability keeps them from being able to communicate in such a manner that they are going to be heard. So
yes,
they can't really advocate for themselves. So you need groups that are going to advocate for you. And that's where, you know, as the child, the parent comes in and they're the advocate. As a part of a couple, you know, the other part of the couple is the advocate. Because, again, sometimes our disability inhibits our ability to communicate effectively, and so we're not able to advocate for ourselves.
Exactly.
And I just wanted to
throw
that part in. Go ahead.
One of the best things about having a psychiatric service dog is that, you know, you're right, many of us cannot, with psychiatric disabilities, we cannot stand up for ourselves very well. We have a very big problem with, you know, asserting ourselves and saying what you're doing is not right, you know, stop treating me that way, things like that. But when you get a service dog, suddenly you're not advocating for yourself anymore. Suddenly you're advocating for your dog and your dog's rights and your dog's needs and your rights with the dog. And you're also advocating for the entire service dog community. And so when you have, for example, a listserv or another online support group of people that have psychiatric service dogs, you can get strength from hearing about other people being able to handle their access challenges. An access challenge, for those who don't know, is just when somebody tries to say, you can't come in here with that dog. And so a lot of people have been able to really overcome that and stand up for the service dog community and stand up for their dog when they can't stand up for themselves at all.
Yes, this is so true. And that's one of the reasons we do this show right here, is to let people know, number one, you're not alone. Number two, there's information out there that you don't know how to access, and we're going to help you to access that information. And number three, some of the things we can't see because we just don't see these things are brought to light through hearing other people's experiences and from other professionals in the community. So that's one of the reasons we do this show. I know that's one of the points in your group as well, is the whole educational part and the whole advocate part. So continue.
Well, I think actually it would be a good idea to switch over to, since you mentioned it, emotional support animals, therapy dogs, and psychiatric service dogs and the difference between those. So really, a lot of people get therapy dogs and psychiatric service dogs confused because people with mental illness go to therapy. So you think, oh, therapy dog is like when you're going to therapy. But actually, they're pretty much opposite from each other. A psychiatric service dog is trained to do worker tasks that help with your disability. And in public, they should be ignoring everyone else and only helping you. A therapy dog, on the other hand, is trained to interact with everyone else, bring joy and happiness to everyone else's life, obey your commands, but really to be very social with other people. So while it is possible to train a dog to do both service dog work and therapy dog work, it can be very confusing for the dog to sometimes have to ignore everyone and then other times go and see everyone. That's the difference between a psychiatric service dog and a therapy dog. Now, an emotional support animal Oh, also, the therapy animals, they do not have, you do not have public access rights with the therapy dog. You can't just take your therapy dog to a restaurant, to the movies, you know, stuff like that, whereas you can with a psychiatric service dog. And therapy dogs are granted access to places like hospitals and libraries and things on a case-by-case basis, only by permission. And so an emotional support animal is a little more similar to a psychiatric service dog. There are two main differences. The first main difference is that while a psychiatric service dog is specifically trained to recognize and respond to your disability with work or tasks, an emotional support animal helps you just by being there. So just the matter of having the dog there helps mitigate your disability, but the dog isn't trained to do anything to help you. It's just there. And it being there, you petting it, you know, all that type of stuff, that is what helps mitigate your disability. The other big difference is that since service dogs have public access, well, their handlers have public access with their service dogs, they are trained to behave in public. Whereas an emotional support animal, I'll go into a little bit further in a second about where they have access, but emotional support animals do not need to be trained to behave in public unless there's some certain special cases. So the main difference is that psychiatric service dogs are trained to do work and tasks. Emotional support animals simply help by being there. And psychiatric service dogs are trained to behave in public, whereas most emotional support animals are about as well trained as your average pet dog. Now, emotional support animals, you can fly with emotional support animals under the Air Carrier Access Act. You have to have a psychiatric disability for having an emotional support animal, I should say. So you can fly with an emotional support animal under the Air Carrier Access Act, and you can have an emotional support animal in housing that does not allow pets. You don't have to pay a pet deposit, anything like that. So you can have an emotional support animal in your home, and in like an apartment that doesn't allow pets, or you know, maybe your emotional support animal is larger than the weight limit on your apartment complex, things like that. And that leads kind of directly into the Air Carrier Access Act, which I just mentioned covers emotional support animals. The Air Carrier Access Act currently treats emotional support animals the same as psychiatric service dogs, and they treat all other types of service dogs completely differently. So if you have a physical disability and you want to fly on an airplane in the United States, you can just show up with your service dog by your side and give credible verbal assurance that your dog is a service dog and they have to allow you to fly with your service dog. However, if you have an emotional support animal or a psychiatric service dog, so they've lumped those together when they really should not be lumped together, you have to provide a letter 48 hours in advance that states you have a disability as described in the DSM, which is the Diagnostic Standards Manual, I believe. But so you have to have a letter saying that you have a mental health disability. You have to provide the letter 48 hours in advance, and there's some special wording needs to be included in the letter, and you have to have the license number of the provider and all that kind of stuff. So it's a really big form of discrimination against psychiatric service dogs because, you know, the reason why was they said they were worried that people were faking psychiatric service dogs, so they wanted to make it harder for people to use psychiatric service dogs. But it's just as easy to fake a seizure disorder as it is to fake a mental illness. So it really doesn't do anything that great towards cutting down on the faking of service dogs. It just discriminates against people with psychiatric service dogs. And I do feel that for emotional support animals, the extra documentation should be required, but not for psychiatric service dogs.
Okay, strongly worded, strongly said. Let me ask you this. Does your organization have a sample doctor's letter or the required verbiage on your website anywhere in the resources or anything?
You know what? Actually, we don't. We have our online listserv, our online support group. That's usually where people ask for the what should be in the letters. And then since there's not any one, like the letters have to be, the same for everybody, and there's also different types of reasons you might want a letter. We don't have the letter templates on our website. You would need a different type of letter for a lot of different things. You would need a certain letter for housing, a different letter for flying. You need a different letter for employment, and you need, if you want, just to have a letter in your file, for proof in case you ever have to go to court that your doctor supported you having a service dog, then that would be even a different letter. So there are four different letters there that I just listed off that you could have. So it really depends on what you need the letter for.
Yes, I do understand that. I've seen on several different sites sample letters. I was just trying to see if maybe your site actually had some of these for these different things. I know that, HUD has some verbiage that they say needs to be in there for housing. And mm-hmm. I saw some specific verbiage that needs to be in there for the airline flights right along with that 48-hour in advance thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two, I haven't seen any on those two different things. But I did see that, and I can appreciate how you have the stance that you have on, I think this is discriminating against psychiatric service dogs as opposed to service dogs in general, because mm-hmm. why is my invisible disability, not getting the same kind of treatment as that visible disability over there, which
mm-hmm.
a lot of us face. And quite frankly, a lot of people who have service dogs, no matter what it is, a mobility or what have you, face some sort of issues because a lot of people's thought of a service dog comes from 40 years ago to where the only service dog was a CNI dog.
Mm-hmm.
And people still have that same kind of thought in their mind, and so sometimes we all have issues with that when it comes to public access. Now, what was your next point that you wanted to make sure you got out to the people?
Well, I think actually it kind of another point that I was talking with a friend about today that kind of dovetails nicely with what we were just talking about is about getting information out to doctors who are needing to prescribe a psychiatric service dog. There is an article that's been written by John Ensminger that explains what every psychologist should know before they write a letter for a psychiatric service dog or an emotional support animal. And the link to that article is in our frequently asked questions, I believe in the laws section. And so I would take a look at that article. But generally, what we would say is to these doctors, make sure they believe the client has a mental health disability. There are a lot of doctors who are thinking they're just writing a letter for just a mental health illness, but they don't know it needs to actually be a disability. And then they need to know that a service dog would help the client, and they should be talking with their client about how to use the dog in their discussions with the client in their therapy sessions, or if it's a psychiatrist, how to use the dog, types of work or tasks the dog can be trained to do. And it's also important to get the person in touch with a private trainer to help them out if they're training their own service dog. It's important for doctors to know the difference between emotional support animals and psychiatric service dogs and to understand what letters they're writing. And to know that their patient is actually going to be taking the dog out in public, thinking that they have their support, so that know that this letter is a big deal to the person.
Yeah, that's very, very important. Now, you just mentioned something again that I wanted to circle around to ask you about.
Sure.
Speak to the thought of the service dog being used in therapy, which you and I know that's not a therapy dog. That's a service
yes.
dog that's being used in therapy for its handler, which is completely different from what a therapy dog is all about.
Mm-hmm.
So speak to that service dog assisted therapy. Go ahead.
Well, my former therapist when I was in the Lompoc area, she said that having a service dog with me, she kind of felt like it was cheating because she could watch the dog's behavior and know what I was going through by watching how the dog was responding to me. Was the dog alerting me? Was the dog doing a strong alert? Was the dog saying, oh, this is no big deal, I'll just take a little nap right now? So that's one way in which it can be helpful in therapy is to help the therapist read the client by the therapist being able to read the more obvious signs of the dog doing their trained behaviors. But other things that you can do in therapy is one of my therapists taught me breathing exercises, and I honestly can never remember what the actual breathing exercises actually are, but what I do is instead of doing the ones that my therapist recommended, I match my breathing to my dog's breathing. My dog breathes my dog is like comfortable and everything, my dog breathes these nice steady breaths, and so I match my breathing to the dog and do these exercises, and I also do what is called grounding. And for people who aren't familiar with cognitive behavioral therapy, you might not know what grounding is. It's basically centering yourself in space and time. And without a dog, people often say things like, well, feel your feet touching the floor. Feel your bottom in the seat of the chair. Like, you really focus on these feelings of things that are going on around you. With a psychiatric service dog, what I like to do for grounding is I like to start petting the dog's ears. And I'm not just petting their ears, I'm actually really feeling the individual hairs in the ears, on the ears. I'm feeling that softness, that silkiness. I'm concentrating on that feeling, moving through my body. And it can really help bring me out of a panic attack. And so when you're disconnected or out of touch with reality, grounding brings you back, that you can engage with what's happening at the moment. And so grounding is one of the best things that a service dog does in therapy. And then another one that is really, really helpful for me and many other people is pressure therapy. And that's where the dog is trained to come up to you, and depending on the size of the dog, some dogs will sit in your lap, some dogs will lay on your feet, some dogs will stand up and put their head in your lap, whatever is most comfortable for you and your dog. The important thing is that the dog recognizes that you need the grounding behavior, and the dog responds to that by providing you their body to their in whatever part of their body they provide you to do that that deep pressure therapy on top of your legs or your chest or wherever you need it.
Yeah, that's a big one, and it's a good one with, you know, my target group for who I do dogs for, and that's when we use deep pressure therapy and the grounding. And so those are two really good things and big things. And your next big thing?
Well, I see it's almost 9 o'clock, so I thought I might skip to just a couple little things that I wanted to mention that are just kind of minor points, and then maybe we can open the lines up for questions. If that's okay with you?
That is well and fine.
Okay. So the first thing is that there's a lot of service dog etiquette that is very well known, like, you know, ignore the dog, don't talk to the dog, don't feed the dog, you know, all that kind of stuff. But one of the things that often doesn't get mentioned is don't take pictures or video of the dog without permission. That can be really very triggering for some people who have issues with, you know, being out in public with their dog, and all of a sudden somebody's coming up to them with a video camera in their face and videotaping their dog. For people with paranoia, this can be like a complete week ruiner for someone with paranoia. Another thing that I wanted to just touch on quickly is something that I find really useful for all different types of service dogs, and that's the ignore command. And the ignore command is basically the same as a leave it command, which leave it means your dog should leave whatever you're talking about alone. The reason you use the word ignore is because this command is not only a command for the dog, it's also a command for the humans. And so when a human comes up to you and starts petting your dog without asking permission and you don't want your dog to be, interacting with them, you tell your dog, ignore, and you repeat over and over again, good, ignore. And you feed your dog treats while you're telling the dog, good, ignore. So your dog continues to focus on you. The person that is petting the dog sees that the dog is not interested in them. And then they kind of get it when all of a sudden they get that the word ignore means their dog is supposed to be not paying attention to them. So probably they should be ignoring the dog as well. And so that is a really great way to kind of, get people who are petting without asking to stop doing it. And also, it's a really good idea to carry flyers with you. I have a flyer for each service dog that I've used that has pictures of that service dog and some answers to commonly asked questions about service dogs. And we have a flyer that people can use on our website under the Frequently Asked Questions page. You can hand this flyer out, and then the person will start reading the flyer, and you can go on your way. And many, many times that I've done that, I've actually had the person come back up to me after, like later on in this grocery store, and apologize for talking to my dog or petting without permission, and say that, it really was helpful to read that information. So that's something that I'd like to put out there to people who are using service dogs to use the ignore command and use flyers or other information to get information out to people without having to, split your day up into 20 different conversations when you get asked a question.
Yeah. Every time I get in a conversation with that, I think about my dogs who are an exception to that whole rule. Our dogs have patches on them that says, ask to touch me, ask to pet me, because with the child with autism, you're trying to give them an open access to the outside world. And so when people see the dog and they want to interact with the dog, and then they ask the young child with autism or, an older child with autism and the parent, and they say, oh, ask to touch me, ask to pet me, hey, can I pet your dog? And then they're actually addressing the kid, which is doing therapy for the kid and helping them out. And to the public, of course, in my mind, as a dog trainer, any dog, I don't care if it's a service dog or any dog, you don't just pet a dog you don't know.
You would like that to be the case.
Can I pet your dog? Many people, they get bit by a dog and then they want to sue somebody, Well, yeah, petting. He didn't ask you to pet him. My dog happens to be jumpy. He doesn't want you to pet him. And no, I don't need to wear a muzzle on my dog just because you don't need to be invading his space. But then when you have a service dog, that just accentuates that even more powerful because, as has been said many times, this dog is working. This dog's job means that this dog is focused on me. If you are interfering with this dog doing his job, that's not real good, and that's a safety hazard for me. And I can't have you just disregarding my health just because you think you see a cute dog.
And I should clarify that if people ask to pet my dog, probably about 90% of the time I let people pet my dog who ask to pet. The only time I use the ignore command is when people don't ask, and they just come up and start petting without having asked. And that's why, for me, I like a patch that says don't distract, because that is not, I don't like the patches that say don't pet, because I do allow people to pet my dog when they ask nicely. So I use don't distract so that they know that, you know, if the dog is cued to do something, then it's fine. And then also, I don't know if you saw, there was an article recently about a girl with a seizure alert dog who the dog was distracted by somebody trying to pet the dog, and the dog missed an alert, and the girl ended up falling down and getting severe rug burn on her face from her seizure. You know, it's definitely scary, and so it's good to know that, you know, definitely ask before petting. Petting is okay if you ask first.
Yeah, petting's not okay if you don't ask. That's just rude. I mean, to me, that's just rude.
I agree.
And, you know, it's like, what are you doing? It's like if you're walking with your child, and I do not equate dogs with children, but you're walking with your child, and people just come up and want to touch and kiss your child. You don't just touch and kiss my child.
Or your wheelchair.
Right, right. Or rub your belly if you happen to be pregnant. I mean, people just take liberties that are just ridiculous. But that's where education comes in. And education is not always just to the handler, but we also have to educate the public, whether it be the store owners, the store managers, the police officers, the emergency crews, but also just the regular old public, people in your neighborhood, people in your community, you know, people that you interact with. Some of us are really too uptight to understand that people just don't know. They're not doing these things, a lot of them, because they're just evil people.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know.
Yep.
And so we have to, you know, deal with our attitudes and do some more educating. And, you know, maybe, just maybe, if we were a little bit less offended by certain things and less defensive and less, you know, pushy about trying to get our rights, you know, we could educate people and then everybody wins. Because when we are not centered, especially when we have a psychiatric service dog, you know, that affects our dog, and that makes our dog work. And, you know, it does affect our mental health as well. So we got to learn better ways to deal with things.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that wasn't warm and fuzzy and all that, but that's just that's just me saying my thing. And I'm going to get back out of your time so you could say your thing. Go ahead.
Oh, I think that we should open it up to questions now, if that's okay with you. I've talked about, I think, almost everything that I had in my notes, but I know I think there are probably questions out there. So what was the phone number again that people call?
All right, let's do this. And while we wait on people to call, we'll let you continue to talk about the points that you skipped over. But the phone number to call in, folks, is 646-668-2499. Now, when you call in, if you have a question, I need you to press the number 1 on your keypad. Then I know that you actually have a question. Otherwise, I'm going to think you're just listening. So I do have a call that just came in, Veronica, so I'm going to let this caller go ahead and talk here in a second. But so hold your...